The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest-growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Hey guys, welcome back to Breaking Banks. I just got in from Abu Dhabi in Dubai this morning, so I'm a little jet lagged. So Sam Moore is joining us and going to help us out in a moment. Just before we get to that, we have a bunch of news that's coming up. I don't know whether you saw, but Apple has prepared their one-touch shopping for the mobile web. In fact, I think our own Ian Carr sort of broke that news out on court, so that's pretty interesting to see that. And also, there's a new startup out in Asia, Tryb, T-R-Y-B, that's getting a lot of traction there, so it'll be interesting to watch those guys. National Australia Bank, or NAB as they're known these days, unveiled a whole new set of tech services for SMEs and for Aussie Rules football fans down there, so check that out. So anyway, I'm going to come back to you later in the show. I was able to pre-record an interview when I was in Dubai earlier this week, and I'm going to bring you that interview with Temenos and some friends. But Sam, are you ready to go now?
I am, Brett. Thank you.
All right, so I might hand over to you. What have you got in store this for the rest of the show, dude?
One, I'd like to thank everyone. For those that aren't familiar with me, just a little bit of background. So I head up the digital practice for Carlisle & Gallagher. That is everybody's favorite consulting firm, as we know, with banks. Also, since last October, I've been managing a project which highlights women leaders in fintech at femtechleaders.com, and we'll actually be talking with two of the women that we profiled in this series today on the show a little bit later. But first of all, we have it's that time of year, we have a ton of conference announcements to get to, and I encourage you, go ahead and get your pen and paper ready, because I'm about to load you up with a ton of discount codes, so definitely pay attention. The first one is Next Bank USA Conference. That'll be in Silicon Valley on May 12th. I'll be there along with, I think, just about anybody who has anything to do with fintech. And Breaking Banks will actually be broadcasting live from the conference. So please go to www.nextbankusa.com to register for this. Use the code BB25 and you'll get a 25% discount. The Finovate team is also bringing you a new conference called Findevr. That's Fin, D-E-V-R, very clever spelling. They'll be focusing solely on the technology side of fintech. It's scheduled for the following week in New York on March 29th. Techies, go to newyork2016.findevr.com. Use the code BBANKS, D-E-V-R-20, for a 20% discount on registration. And just before the Next Bank conference, Finovate Spring will happen in San Jose. That'll be on May 10th. Through the 11th. Use the code BREAKINGBANKS20 to save a 20% discount on the current ticket price. And last but not least, Brett will be speaking at the Retail Banking Analytics Europe Conference on June 20th through the 21st. That'll take place in London. And we'll talk more about that a little bit later in the show.
Actually, Sam, I just organized a deal in Istanbul as well on May 16th, and they bought 1,500 copies of my new book to give away at the conference. So I'm going to give some more details of that as well.
Well, that would explain the pick I got from Brett on his flight back with a thing of champagne. And we'd also like to encourage you, we have the Breaking Banks newsletter. You can sign up for that at the website at breakingbanks.com. We highly encourage you to do that and find out what we're interested in and what we're reading and talking about for the current week. Now we'd like to jump to our first guest. This is a very good friend of mine, Gila Boscovich. Gila is from Zafin, and I have had the pleasure of working with Gila from, I don't know, Gila, how many months now, working on this FemTech project. Gila, are you there?
I am, Sam. How are you today? Exciting to hear you in New York.
I'm wonderful.
It's very loud, Gayla. A little distortion.
Oh, sorry about that. Is that better? That's better.
Yeah,
Thank you.
So Gayla and I actually met for the first time at Sibos in Singapore back in October. I had interviewed and profiled Gayla as part of this FemTech Leader Series. And little did I know that Gayla would become a huge part of my life from that moment on.
Sound like you guys are getting married or something.
Yeah, my wife. Not at all what's happening.
I'm just staring, Sam.
I want to get killed. But I'll tell you what I learned about Gayla very early on. And I've used this word very few times with other people. It kind of ties back to your AI interest there, Brett. Gayla is a machine, and I mean that in the nicest way possible. I've never seen anyone that can network, organize, and get things done like Gayla. That's a huge
compliment. You need to help me launch my new book then, Gayla.
Oh, Brett, I've got some ideas. We need to talk.
Okay.
Thanks, Sam.
From going from 0 to 100, how many conferences, how many meetups now, and in what cities have you set up for this FemTech Leader Series?
Well, it's crazy, and I need to really acknowledge that it's the community that is making this happen. So all of these amazing women that you profiled, and the men that are involved in this have really come together to make it possible for us to gather. But we have Sydney. In fact, Sydney's chapter had a meetup last night with New Finance, where Blythe Masters, one of our own FemTech leaders we've profiled, was talking blockchain. And they've got another one coming up in April on the 27th, but they're rocking and rolling. And a huge thanks to Tiro FinTech Hub, and especially Michelle Moffitt and Jessica Ellum for making this happen. They are the powerhouses that are pushing Sydney. And we've got New York actually coming up next week. It's the same day as FinDevor. And Davis Wright Tremaine and Lynn Loecker and Allison May have been amazing in hosting us and sponsoring us. So we're meeting up again on Tuesday in New York. The great thing about Money 2020 coming up is we've managed to get a meetup set up for the 5th in Copenhagen. And thank you so much to ACI for stepping up. And Sylvia Pooley, who runs their practice in Europe, made that happen. And she's another one of our FemTech leaders that you've profiled. We've got London coming up on the 26th of April. And that's been sponsored by Lloyd Digital Hub. And Claire Calmjane has been phenomenal in the support there. Amsterdam is kicking off on the 28th of April. And Angelique Schouten from Open, they're hosting us and sponsoring us there. So looking forward to Amsterdam. And lo and behold, we actually have Singapore on deck as well, which is set for May 5th. And we're doing that in partnership with Next Bank. And thoroughly excited to be meeting up at the Singapore Exchange. It's going to be, already we've got over 200 people signed up for that alone. And there are a couple of spaces left. If you want to get in, you need to sign up quickly. But drop me a line if you're interested. Shout at me on Twitter. The handle is Gayla Bushkovic, and I can give you more details. But, I mean, we're pulling up cities all over the map. I'm hoping we can get one coordinated for the next big Silicon Valley one as well. That's on the next target list, so.
Yeah. As of now, we've hit every continent except Africa. So if anyone's listening, step up.
Exactly.
And don't forget Next Bank Antarctica coming to you soon.
Exactly.
Yes. Absolutely. No, and we have plans for all of these cities. And for the one-offs that we have at conferences, it's a fabulous way for all of us who live globally, travel globally, to finally get a chance to meet and know each other in person. And that's actually what is really the most important, is the personal relationships that we build in this industry are what are going to move us forward. And that's the whole point of this, is let's connect, let's create some differences, let's actually create change and be change agents locally in our own organizations and globally, because we have the power to do that. And this is what FemTech Leaders means to me, and this is why I am so excited that Sam and I get to work together. And it's not really a marriage so much as it is more like a brother-sister family team, because that's exactly what this thing feels like. FemTech is a family.
Yes, thank you. That was for Mindy Mall, who's in Jacksonville right now. Just for your ears. Of course, it's a brother-sister relationship. It's just speaking in New Orleans a day ago or 2 days ago at a payments conference, and I ran into somebody from CGI, and they said, yeah, this gala reached out to me to ask me to be a manbassador. So I think you've trademarked that term as part of this program.
Awesome.
So it's
awesome. Well, I'm talking to two exceptional manbassadors right now, Brett, Sam, and you guys are it, right? That's exactly what you are. You're part of this. You're part of the family. And I know from personal experience how much it means to you to make sure that this is a diverse and collaborative, interesting industry. One thing that actually comes to mind is kind of the business case of why it matters right now that we're paying attention to this. And it's looking at the markets that fintech and banks serve, and who actually takes control of most of the household decisions. It's women. And when we're designing products or we're designing services that are supposed to serve our customers in the best way possible, we can't have a really myopic or homogeneous set of team members designing those things because we don't get the necessary points of view or perspective. So the business case for having diversity on a team makes sense just in terms of looking at who you're actually going to end up serving, those customers. And the other thing that kind of comes to mind is just basic physics and engineering, right? Any organization, any construction, any building can't be unbalanced. It has to have balance in order to stand up or even exist and function. So why wouldn't you reflect that in your organization? You know, just a couple of thoughts about why it's actually relevant and why it really, really matters and people should be paying attention to this.
Yeah, it's, you know, I found it very interesting as I've gone through the series and interviewed the different individuals for this program so far. The network effect has been outstanding. And to give a shout out from the manbassador side, the family that's around Breaking Banks, so the folks you hear all the time, the Dave Birches, the Chris Skinners, the Simon Taylors, the J.P. Nichols, they all
Don't forget Jim Morales.
Jim for sure.
Jim's kind of, you know, what we love. And they've all been, you know, the whole group has been incredibly supportive. The meetup that we had in London, that of course I wasn't there, but just about everybody else was, and the crowd was fantastic. Again, Clara Calma-Jane and the team at Lloyd's, it was wonderful to see the support that Lloyd's had provided for that. And, you know, I've been able to attend one so far in New York, and, you know, Gayla is incredibly good at getting up and giving a moving speech. She brought me to tears. The wine and the drinks. Great night. We highly encourage everyone. What I would say is just follow Gayla on Twitter, and you'll be able to see, you know, the work that we're doing and where we're going with this. So, Gayla, thank you so much for joining. We really appreciate it. And thank you so much for the support for this program.
Well, my thanks in return, Sam. Thank you, Brett. Seriously, the support that you've channeled our way is amazing. And I'm not doing this alone. It's the community that's doing this. So props to my fellow FemTech leaders. You're amazing. And my gratitude knows no boundaries. I can't thank you enough.
Yeah, thank you, Gayla. So we have two guests on the show today. Both of them have been profiled as part of this series. So again, if you go to www.femtechleaders.com, you'll be able to see the profiles of each. We have Michelle Kaktix, who's the CEO of Bankers Lab, who's coming in of about, 20,000 miles away in Thailand right now. Michelle, are you on?
Hi, Sam. This is Michelle. Can you hear me okay?
I can. Thanks, Michelle. And we also have Tahira Dosani from Accession in their venture lab. And I believe you're in Washington, D.C., right, Tahira?
Yes, it's Tahira, and I am here in Washington, D.C.
And just so everyone knows, Tahira actually sent me the phonetic spelling of her name, and this entire call, I will never get it right. So Brett's also very good at that. So everyone level set, okay? Brett's been hosting the show for 180 episodes, and it's amazing how he mispronounces his name. So, Brett, you can't get too hard.
Come on, I try.
It's happened. So let's actually start with Michelle, because you're calling in from the farthest distance. Michelle, in talking with you, we were on a phone call when I interviewed you for the program. I was in Jacksonville, Florida, in my home. You're in a part of Thailand I can't pronounce, Chiang Mai, I believe, if I say it.
Chiang Mai, that's right.
Excellent. And we were talking, and we realized that only 2 weeks prior to that, we were within about 15 feet of each other in Singapore at Cybos, just to tell you how the FinTech space is. And one of my favorite comments that you had during your call, your career is unbelievable. You've worked for the Federal Reserve, the IMF, Fair Isaac, Standard Chartered Bank, you take your pick, yet you don't call yourself a banker. Well, why is that?
Yeah, I think it's always just been an adventure. And when I was at the IMF, well, I wasn't sure what I was supposed to call myself then. And when I was at FICO, being on the vendor side, I very much felt like a practitioner because it was a very specific technical skill set that I felt like I was delivering. And then when I was in Standard Chartered, maybe I was more of an entrepreneur, although colleagues maybe thought I was more just a rabble-rouser. So finally, I may be the most banker I've ever been now that I'm on the fintech side as a fintech startup CEO. I'm not sure. But I guess when you approach the whole thing as a big adventure and always looking for new things to shake up and kind of do the version zero of whatever it is that you're in the middle of, I don't know, it's hard to think of myself as a typical banker at that point.
Yeah, one of my favorite things you told me was former colleague of yours at Standard Charter, his name was Rob Cookson, was describing you, and he said, what people don't understand about Michelle is that the banking part is just a blip. It doesn't define her. Because, I mean, help me out here.
I know how that feels.
Firefighter, you've done emergency, I can't even keep up with all the jobs you have. You should be on the A-team, right? You're one of
Well, you know, I used to live in California when I worked for FICO, and in California, it's normal that you're an emergency medical technician or a firefighter, and you have to drop out of a conference call to go deal with an emergency situation. Nobody in California really thought much of it, which is one of the amazing and wonderful facets of California culture. So only when I came to Asia, people thought that was kind of strange. And then, of course, all of my vacations are adventures, which are either trekking in the Himalaya, cycling across Burma or Laos, things like that. So, yes, in Asia, they also thought that was a bit strange. But the good news is people remember you. So if that's any solace, that seems to help.
So if you're wondering how we came up with the idea of having both Michelle and Tahira on the call at the same time, you're about to learn why. So we already know Michelle. You've just heard her background and that sense of adventure that she has. To help put this in perspective, and for those that listen, you might know I have 4 kids of my own, 3 daughters, and I'm putting myself in Tahara's parents' shoes right now. Tahira, you, coming out of college, you went to work for Bain Consultancy Group, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And that's like the pinnacle. I work for a consultancy firm. Remember, everybody's favorite firm, Carlisle & Gallagher. But Bain is okay. You know, they're... They're all right. So coming right out of school to go to work for Bain, and I think at the age of 22 or 23, you made the decision in 2006 to go to Afghanistan. So whatever tourist agency talked you into that, you needed to get your money back. Now, how did you come about it? That's a huge life decision at an incredibly young age. Can you kind of give us some background on how that came about?
Sam, I'm surprised you don't think of Kabul as a top tourist hotspot. But no, you know, it's a good question. I think there were a few factors that drove that. One was, as much as I really enjoyed the consulting work that I was doing, I did feel removed from operations, removed from the implementation. A lot of times as a consultant, you have great exposure, you have great opportunity to think through recommendations, but then you give those recommendations to someone and hand it off, and you're not responsible for how they get implemented. And that distance, as you know, it makes you wonder what actually happens after this. And so that was one driver. And then the second was really, I've always been interested in, you know, the idea of promoting development and opportunity globally. But what I didn't love about what I'd seen in in philanthropy and in the nonprofit sector was the idea that you either can make money or you can have impact, and that there's a trade-off between the two, that they're not that they're mutually exclusive in some way. And so the opportunity to go to Afghanistan was really one to get my hands a little bit dirty, go work with a telecoms operator, work to implement, not just create recommendations. And then secondly, to test the idea of development being driven through the private sector, eliminating the notion of trade-offs.
So I have to comment just a little bit here. One, that's incredibly admirable, and the huge task you took on. I mean, you went to Afghanistan, you went to Kabul in 2006, and if you all remember going back, that wasn't exactly the that was a war zone. There's just no other way to put it. And I think you told me you lived on an actual compound, right?
Yeah, all of the expat staff that worked for Roshan, which is the telco operator that I worked for, lived in a compound together.
How many other 22 or 23-year-old women?
I was the youngest there, and one of the only a couple of women out of about 100 expats. So, it was a challenge. There's no getting around that. I mean, Afghanistan is not the easiest place to live and work, especially as a woman, especially as a young woman, but it's also a country with tremendous opportunity. It's a country that had very little communications infrastructure. And so being able to build that, to develop that, to learn and test a new market, one that really was commerce as a whole was very new to that market, and then explore the launch of new products, particularly at the intersection of technology and financial services, the launch of mobile money and those things, and see how quickly and tangibly they had an impact on the development of the economy and the social sector in that country. It was really amazing.
Yeah, it's just the story itself. It's the show's producer, Rachel, and I were sitting here right before the call deciding who you're going to cast in the role of you in the movie of your life, and then the same with Michelle. And we'll get to that later, but we have landed on the actresses. We want to represent each of you. Michelle, coming back to you, because again, it's this whole concept of the care and the idea that both of you want to make an impact, but actually doing something with it, right? You've really stepped outside of yourselves, if you will, to do this. Michelle, going from banking, you went to work for a clinic. In I think it was on the Burmese border, wasn't it?
That's right. Just before the global financial crisis, I decided, well, looks like people aren't interested in what risk managers have to say. Maybe I'll try a different career. And I thought I might want to go into public health based on my background in my side careers. And I volunteered at a place called Maytel Clinic, www.maytelclinic.org, shout out. And yes, it's a refugee clinic set up by the folks who were refugees from the 1988 pro-democracy uprising in Burma. And it's run by Cynthia Monk, who's a Nobel nominee. And I went there and I thought, oh, I'll just stay for a couple months so I can get a view into what a public health career might look like. I ended up staying for 2 years, and this is the kind of volunteering. This is not, ladling out food in a soup kitchen. This is kind of screaming, trying not to throw your cell phone sometimes, frustration, tearing out your hair, some, two steps forward, one step back, and really the biggest thing is lots and lots of learning how to do stuff that you're not good at. So it was, I think the key for me was this huge learning curve of doing things that I had never done before.
And so you went from that experience, and I think you worked with a Nobel Prize nominated doctor, correct?
That's right. Her name is Dr. Cynthia Monk. She's still there. They just moved into a new clinic facility there on the border. And they now work in very close collaboration with the Thai and Burmese government, now that the political situation has changed, although unfortunately for that population of people, all of the big medical and healthcare challenges still exist. And some of those areas inside Burma, which is now called Myanmar, are still heavily underserved and have no access to healthcare. And some of those parts of Myanmar still have active conflict going on. So most of the medics that worked in our clinic, we had 600 employees, I think right now they probably have about the same, came from active conflict zones. So one thing is, a startup company, we always say, oh, if we can't make payroll and you run out of money, it's so terrible. In the clinic, if that happened, if I didn't raise enough money, you know, we would have to shed employees and they would have to go back into the war zone that was where their home village was. So sort of not making payroll had much bigger implications. So the good news is, in a startup company, you know, I say, well, you guys can't scare me.
I wish we had another hour. I really do. What I'd encourage everyone to do, take a look at the website. Take a look at the interviews on femtechleaders.com. The stories, I'm really not joking. We need to write to Hollywood and get both of their life stories done. What I'd encourage everyone to do, again, take a look at that site. What I'd like to talk about, though, is what you're doing today, the work that you're doing. So, one, Tahira, coming back to you, you work for an outstanding organization, one that I've been able to interview both yourself and Jackie Hyland. Can you talk a little bit about your role right now and what you're doing?
Absolutely. So today I work with Axion's Venture Lab. And Axion is an organization that's been working in the financial inclusion space for several decades, really for almost 50 years, predominantly working with investing in and supporting the growth of microfinance institutions. And over the past few years, Axion has begun an impact investing initiative called Venture Lab, which makes seed stage equity investments in fintech and financial inclusion startups globally. And my role within Venture Lab is to lead our post-investment portfolio support. So once we've invested in a startup, I work really closely with the entrepreneur, with the management team of that startup, to provide strategic and operational support to them. So it's a pretty fantastic role. I get to spend my days working with really passionate, talented entrepreneurs who are working to solve significant challenges with their businesses. And I get to work with them on some of their largest problems and helping them work through those. So it's incredibly fun, incredibly inspiring.
And I encourage everyone to take a look at the site and read about this, the work that this organization has done. I went out on YouTube to learn a bit more. And Axion actually is back in the 60s, right? If I saw this right. Just fantastic, especially around something near and dear to me, which is financial inclusion. And the same is true with you, Michelle. So you run Bankers Lab, and I love your analogy. You're a flight simulator for banks. Can you give us a bit more about what you do?
Sure. When I was an executive at Standard Chartered, we saw all these Asian countries go through boom and bust credit cycles, and you see a lot of social disruption. So on one hand, the double-edged sword of the financial inclusion is that we grow fast, we give a lot of credit to these new credit populations, but then they get overlent and you have these blow-ups, which can be catastrophic for those borrowers. And what I realized is that the more we can educate both the borrowers and the bankers to avoid these boom and bust cycles in lending, the better. And so we built this software service platform, which pumps out virtual portfolios that people can practice managing before they practice managing the real ones. And the idea is that we can continue to dampen those cycles, and hopefully this will support, you know, sustainable and safe lending.
Well, that's again, everyone, I highly encourage you, take a look at Bankers Lab, take a look at Accession and their Venture Lab and the work they're doing. Please read the profile of these two incredibly brave individuals. There, you can see the storyline overlap of what they've done and their focus on others, which is one of the things we really try to focus in on when we talk about the FemTech Leader Series. I want to thank both of you for joining us today. Again, I wish we had more time, but we're up against the clock. Again, thank you both. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Sam. Great to speak.
Thank you. Before we go to break, we're actually starting a new segment for this show. We're calling it the FinTech Five. And this is where we're going to put startup founders and other innovators on the hot spot. Basically give them 5 minutes and we do rapid fire questions. Our first is with Matt Burton, who's one of the co-founders of Orchard Platforms. So we're going to throw this over, listen to this interview we did with Matt, and hope you enjoy this new series.
Today we have the pleasure of talking with Matt Burton. He's the CEO and one of the founders of Orchard Platforms. Hey Matt, how are you?
I'm good.
Okay, good. And let me give everyone a little bit of trivia because this will come into the conversation at some point. Matt is the proud 3-time state champion from Texas in tennis.
Indeed.
Indeed. All right, Matt, you ready for this? We're going to get the clock started and jump right in.
I hope so.
The clock starts now. So what's the elevator pitch for Orchard?
Orchard is a technology platform and marketplace lending. We provide institutional investors and platforms with the tools they need in order to make online lending the next big asset class.
Where did the seed idea for the company come from?
Like most good ideas, you know, it emerged organically. Angela and I, one of my co-founders, were investing in the space, starting to build tools to help us manage our own portfolios. That led to us getting hired as consultants as institutional investors started moving into the space. And as consultants, we realized that this problem was quite large and that there needed to be a dedicated company that was focused on solving it. And so over the course of a couple of years, it kind of matured.
When exactly was the company founded?
The company was founded in 2013.
In that short time so far, how would you say Orchard's actually changed the marketplace lending space?
Yeah, so I think the most notable change is we have accelerated institutional investor capital into the space. And we've also been able to provide a transparency on a level that they expect in order to be able to put, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars into a new space. And, you know, we really view ourselves as building infrastructure that will, you know, scale this industry from, you know, today, which, you know, is anywhere between $25 and $30 billion into hundreds, if not trillions of dollars.
Who are your clients? I mean, what types of institutions use Orchard as a service?
Today we have family offices, hedge funds, BDCs. You know, we work with banks and are continuing to expand the number of institutional investors. On the platform side, we mainly work with consumer and small business originators.
And roughly how many employees do you have right now?
Today we have 48 employees in New York and one in San Francisco.
And what's their background? What's the mix you look for in your team members?
Yeah, so we actually have a really unique mix. You know, I came from an online advertising background, spent a lot of time at Google, and so did many of the team members here at Orchard, which what I would call more of a pure tech background, coming from Bloomberg, Twitter, Facebook, Google, kind of that brief. And then the other half of the Orchard team really has more of a financial services background, specifically within risk. So Angela, who I talked about before, came out of the underwriting group at Citibank, before that American Express, and we have, you know, many more kind of data science analytical backgrounds within the company.
I think one of the things that's very interesting about your company is a lot of the investors in your company are ex-bankers. Do you find anything ironic about that, in all honesty?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first time that, you know, I was meeting John Mack or Vikram Pandit or Tom Gloser, you know, I didn't really know what they were going to think of, you know, a startup kind of disrupting, you know, a space where, you know, they were the ultimate incumbents. But I was actually really surprised in my conversations to realize how passionate they were that, you know, traditional financial services needs to change, and that they really believed in all the fintech activity that's going on. And over the past 2 years, I mean, even after investing in Orchard, they've gone on to continue to invest in the space in significant ways, which I think is a big testament to the potential.
All right, so we're down to our last 30 seconds. We're going to get to rapid fire, okay? So short answers here. See how many you can get in. It's like the Ellen Show.
Ready.
Describe being a startup founder in 2 words.
Passionate, persistent.
True or false, your company headquarters has a ping pong table in it.
True.
Who came up with the name of the company?
I did. It comes from Orchard Street, where I used to live in downtown Manhattan.
Borg or McEnroe?
McEnroe.
Describe the culture of Orchard in a single sentence.
Orchard is a passionate group of technology and finance-backed entrepreneurs who are looking to change the world.
Finish this sentence. The future belongs to those who...
The future belongs to those who make it happen.
Great answer. I like that. You can tell you're a founder. Where can we find out more about Orchard, Matt?
So the best place is the Orchard website, but we also attend almost all of the industry events. So both are good places.
Excellent. Well, thanks again, Matt, for your time. I appreciate it.
It was a good interview, Sam.
And Matt's and the whole company is really fascinating to take a look at. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Temenos. Temenos is having a series of innovation jams this year. Brett and JP Nichols have already hosted one, I believe one in Miami and one in Singapore.
Yeah, JP was just in Singapore last week. It was a good effort.
I'd like to thank Brett for taking Miami, which is only like a couple hours from my house. So instead, I'll be flying all the way to Dubai on April 6th to host Temenos Jam there in Dubai. We'd encourage you, go to breakingbanks.com for information and a link to the registration on Temenos Innovation Jam. And now we're going to take a quick break.
Hi, it's Brett King here. I wanted to reach out to you personally to let you know about my new book, Augmented Life in the Smart Lane, which comes out the first week of May. I'm so excited about this book. It's going to be available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, of course, through your local bookstore. But this book has taken 2 years of my life. Thousands of hours of research have gone behind it. We've got some amazing contributions from the likes of Alex Lightman, Andy Lark from Xero, JP Rangaswamy from Deutsche Bank and Salesforce. We have interviews with Ramez Naam, an award-winning sci-fi author, roboticist Elliot Mack, Dr. Giovanni Santostasi on The Activated Self, Dr. Hugh Herr from MIT, Brad Templeton on the Google Self-Driving Car. Listen, if you enjoyed my podcast, you're excited about the future and the opportunities it presents, then Augmented is going to be a book you're really going to enjoy. Robert Scoble, the West Coast commentator on technology, he said, "We're in the midst of a huge wave of technological change, augmented reality, self-driving cars, human-like robots." Brett King not just properly catalogues all of these things, but he tells us what it all means, that soon we will be augmented. His look at what's happening will be my Bible for a long time. Check out augmentedbook.com or go to Amazon and pre-order it. I'd really appreciate your support.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account. One that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account. One that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Moovin is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Moovin today.
Business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
Hey guys, welcome back to Breaking Banks. You can follow the discussion on Breaking Banks using hashtag Breaking Banks on Twitter, rather. And earlier in the week, I was in Abu Dhabi and managed to record this interview with Temenos and with Anthemis Group regarding a new report they've done. So have a listen to this, and if I don't see you before next week's show, I'll catch you again next week. Here's this recording I did earlier in Abu Dhabi. If you've been a regular listener to Breaking Banks, you know that we have the very kind sponsorship of Temenos. And they're back on the show this week. We have Ben Robinson, who's the Chief Strategy Marketing Officer or something like that, isn't it, Ben? Welcome back.
Thank you, Brett. Good to be back.
And we also have joining us to talk about a report in a moment that Anthemis and Temenos partnered on. We have David Galbraith. David.
Hi, how you doing?
Now, David, you run the foundry at Anthemis?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, good. So we've had Anthemis on a few times. In fact, I was just with Sean Park last week. He was in New York and we had dinner together. Always great to catch up with Sean. If you don't know who Anthemis Group is, they led the seed round for Moovin, so they've got a soft spot in my heart. And they're one of the preeminent fintech investment companies out there, based in London but do activity all around the globe. You know, they're early stage investors in Betterment, in Simple, in Moovin, Currency Cloud, and many others. So they're really a staple in the space. But listen, before we get into the report that you guys worked on, Ben, I wanted to also ask about the new Microsoft Temenos partnership that you guys announced earlier in the week. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Yeah, so we've been partnering with Microsoft for I think sort of 6 or 7 years now, and what we've just launched this week is a big marketing campaign. And I don't know if you've seen them, but Microsoft do these, they've got this big campaign around the cloud, and they've done a campaign with Real Madrid, they've done a campaign with National Geographic. And the latest one, which went live this week, is with us, and which is very exciting. And it's showcasing the work we've done with Microsoft, with the Microsoft Cloud, to improve financial inclusion. And hopefully, I mean, if people want to see it, it's on YouTube. You can see it on our social channels, but hopefully people should see it as they walk to the airports and when they're watching TV, because it's a pretty big campaign.
So, this is pretty cool. I mean, some of the stuff they're doing with HoloLens and some of these other things are very exciting right now. So be really keen on sort of seeing how that integrates its way into the banking space. I don't know whether it's going to be, I think initially people might perceive it like Second Life, you know, in terms of sort of banking collaboration. Let's have a virtual bank branch with augmented reality. But I think the potential is a lot stronger than that. So be interesting to see the moves that Microsoft make. Also Kinect, just even that base technology that Kinect has with the Xbox, the ability to use that and, sort of use that for things like biorecognition and, biometrics and stuff like that. There's a lot of potential. Working on actually any technology integration together? I mean, you've been working with them for a while.
Yeah, I mean, so the partnership started really around SQL for banking, and then what we've been really working on over the last few years is putting our applications into the Microsoft Cloud. And because it's all about financial inclusion, and like so often people think the problem with financial inclusion is demand. People don't want demand to don't want access to banking services, but the issue is pretty much always on the supply side. It's that we can't get the financial services at the right price point and across the right channel to the people who need them. And we're making massive progress with this partnership, because we've been able to reduce the cost of lending by upwards of 90%, and wow, by using infrastructure services like the Microsoft Cloud. And one statistic you'll see if you look at the video or the advert that we've got, the TV commercial, is like to highlight the sort of the exponential change. Like so Temenos has been doing microfinance for 20 years, and it took us 20 years to bank 10 million people. And just in the last 2 years, we banked a further 10 million people. So you can see that curve, as we really leverage technologies like the cloud and like mobile. So it's pretty exciting stuff.
Well, it actually leads into sort of the paper that you guys have done, because one of the things that really came through and the paper that you guys have launched, which I'm not sure when you've launched or when it's launching, but the low balance sheet myth, it really focuses on the fact that previously looked at
the value of an institution was the balance sheet. But now in the digital era, when we look at, and you kick this off in the first paragraph of the report, when we look at Uber, which is the world's largest taxi company, Airbnb, which is the world's largest hospitality company, Facebook, the world's largest media owner, but creates no content, you don't have to have a big balance sheet to be compelling in financial services anymore. So tell us about this report. I don't know, David, do you want to kick this off? Or
So the report came about trying to put some proper intellectual underpinning to what we were trying to do in the Foundry, which was company building. And if you like, we have to be very targeted there, because this is not like building an accelerator, which is spray and pray. This is spearfishing, if you like the analogy. We're going out looking for really big opportunities that we can unpick. I'd previously done a foundry in with the PayPal founders in San Francisco, and the idea was to replicate that. And so we heard this myth about, we now think is a myth about companies necessarily having a low balance sheet, like Uber not owning any cars. And we thought, well, is this true? And tried to look at really what the nature of balance sheets across the board are now that we have technology companies that aren't really technology companies. So, Airbnb, is that a technology company, or is it a company that's leveraging technology? And so we wrote this paper, and then I met Ben, and Ben sort of said, well, the last conference I was at, he said 80% of the presenters were trotting out this thing about necessarily digital era companies had low balance sheets. And he said, is this true? Let's dig in and have a look. And so we think we've kind of burst the bubble on that myth and really shown that companies in the technology era don't necessarily have a smaller balance sheet. The earliest opportunities were for big digital platforms that could find gaps in the ecosystem that allowed them to have low balance sheet. There is no overall trend, and a lot of these companies are actually building larger balance sheets. And obviously that has a tremendous...
And you give an example of Tesla in the latter part of the report is obviously a company that's building a considerable balance sheet.
Yeah, I mean, Tesla is the most extreme form of a balance sheet you can imagine. It's a car company that has to own its own gas stations, if you like, with its electricity charging stations. So, but what it's doing is building a large infrastructure for the lowest price possible, given those constraints.
Okay, and Ben, where does Temenos sit in terms of this, in terms of, how does this change value creation and the way we think about core systems and things like that?
Yeah, as David said, this is sort of less of a Temenos Anthemis partnership and more of a kind of, Dave and I were chatting, and we were both actually writing a paper on the same topic, so we thought we'd just collaborate. And
sure.
But the Temenos angle is that, if you've seen in the paper, there's three parts. The first part, we kind of look at these internet platforms that are supposedly asset light, and we actually demonstrate that they're not as asset light as we think, and they're becoming asset heavier over time. And also, one of the interesting things we saw was that as they become asset heavier, the return on capital goes down, because the second part of that kind of balance sheet light theory is that, one, these companies don't have much in the way of assets, and secondly, they earn super kind of normal profits. So that's the first part we look at that. The second part we, as David said, we look at the broader kind of digital area companies like Tesla, and we look at companies in the publishing space. We look at companies in the retailing space like Zara. And then the last part, I suppose, is the part that's most relevant to Temenos and Anthemis, where we then sort of, we look at the fintech sector through this lens of digital era companies and routes to customers rather than balance sheets. And our finding there is that we don't think that it would be possible to be a really, really successful fintech company without having, assets. And actually, we show some examples of fintech companies that become asset heavier over time. And I suppose what's of interest for Temenos is that, one route to getting the assets that fintech companies need is through partnering with banks. And clearly, we've got this big project to put those two communities together through the marketplace and also through the innovation jams.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how we start to see the consolidation of the fintech space emerging. Will we see fintechs acquiring other fintechs? We're already seeing banks experiment with that, BBVA, Capital One, and others. But there appears to be an opportunity for maybe some consolidation of the fintech sector as well in the near term.
Yeah, I mean, you have that
I think you've quoted that statistic, that amazing statistic. There are something like 20,000 fintech companies out there, and that it feels like that ecosystem at some point will have to consolidate. And I think one of the interesting things we've seen in the last couple of weeks is fintechs partnering with fintechs. And I think that's probably a big, emerging trend, which is we should keep an eye on.
Yeah, we're a big fan of that. We announced a partnership we had with Common Bond and Payoff in the US, and we're experimenting with something with Lending Club now. So yeah, there's and with Freelancers Union. So I think there's real potential.
As you said, we talk about distribution of financial services, and we think it could be Apple or Google or something like that distributing, or it could be the banks distributing the fintechs. And one possibility, of course, is that the fintechs distribute the fintechs, and that's maybe what we're seeing now. That it's an alternative.
Well, we're starting to see the second tier of neo-banks now in the UK with Mondo and others. So, David, you have in the report, you talk about the increases in fintech investments. You have the examples of Nordea and also Fidor Bank, where you have sort of some viewpoint. So, Michael Panovich, who's gone from MBank to Nordea, he's always been a big proponent that, the big banks can get there. But is part of this the rate of innovation? Does that have an impact on your ability to grow the balance sheet?
I'm not sure. I don't think, I'm coming from outside financial services and seeing a sector that it's not my background. This sector, for me, is most like something like healthcare in terms of it being a highly regulated one. And because of that, the dynamics of disruption aren't natural, if you like. They will evolve through a complex dynamic of regulation and technological innovation. I don't think anyone can predict exactly how this plays out, what financial services looks like in the future. We know some obvious things. We know that insurance is going to become much more granular because there's going to be more data being collected and better ways to crunch that data so you can create smaller pools of smooth risk. But we don't know what the future of banking looks like 100%, and it could follow one or more different paths. Banking could become a utility business with then a bunch of fintech-like stuff in front, or it could become very vertically integrated and just reassemble, rebundle, but in a different form. And so I guess
I did see in part two when you talk about digital platforms to digital era companies, and one of these concepts is the sort of the business fitness landscape you talk about. But let me throw this at you both and see whether you've got an opinion on this. As we start to move towards quite different models around automation and artificial intelligence, and replacing swathes of processes and people that have typically made up a large part of the balance sheet, do you think that the ability of a business to operate based on AI could make a big difference to return on capital, return on equity, and the balance sheet model because of AI?
AI is at the top of the hype cycle, if you like, at the moment. It's just one of a series of technologies that are important. I don't think it's necessarily the most important one.
But it has potential for massive disruption. I mean, you saw Obama's comments. I don't know if you guys have seen Obama's comments earlier this week where he said about any job that's $20 an hour is under threat, because that could be automated.
So, I'm an optimist in these things. I think a lot of, so I was watching the Steve Jobs movie the other night, and that opens with Arthur C. Clarke saying 30 years ago, computers are going to mean you can live anywhere. And the reality, of course, is that people then started moving not to the countryside, but back into cities. So I suspect that there will be new jobs created and that AI won't be the end of the world. Basically.
I was just going to add a point there, which is, I think when we see changes in technology and new routes to market open up, what we see, what we've observed in this report is that what companies build is different types of assets. So, there's we tend to think of, Facebook, et cetera, as having very few assets, but actually they have very few physical assets and lots of intangible assets. So I suspect, you know, as we move to AI or, you know, blockchain, additive manufacturing, whatever the next big technology shift is, we'll see new routes to the market, new routes to customers open up, and therefore new business models. And they may initially be asset light, but they become asset heavy over time. And those assets are probably likely not to be particularly physical in substance.
Yeah. All right. So where can we get a copy of the report, guys?
So you can get, or people can get a copy from either the Temenos website or the Anthemis website, or they can.
Or just search on Google the low balance sheet myth. Would they find it that way?
The title is the digital era business landscape, debunking the low balance sheet myth. And it's available now.
All right, great. All right, fantastic. Well, thanks again for coming on the show and talking about this. Also, I'll get Rachel to tweet out the link to the report. So if you're listening to the show, go to the Breaking Banks Twitter feed and you should be able to find it there. That's it for the show this week. Thank you, Ben, and thank you, David, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And if you want to check out more on Temenos, who's been a fantastic sponsor for the show, go to temenos.com and also, you know, we link to a lot of their stuff through the site frequently. So thanks again for being on the show, guys. And that's a wrap for the show this week. And we'll see you guys next week.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific time, 3 p.m. Eastern time, for more of the latest in fintech news. Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.